الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على رسول الكريم وعلى آله وأصحابه ومن استنى بسنتي يوم الدين. All praise is due to Allah. May Allah's peace and blessings be on the last Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وسلم and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. Today, we begin the last section of the book أعلام السنة المنشورة لاعتقاد الطائفة الناجية المنصورة by Sheikh Hafiz ibn Ahmed al-Hakami. This book was begun by Sheikh Abdul Rauf. For those of you who are joining late, and the earlier principles of aqidah for Ahl Sunnah were covered. What remains in the last part of the book is the complicated area of qadr and shu'ab al-iman, which are the branches of Iman. I mean, that closes the book with the branches of Iman. The author, Al-Hakami, is among the Saudi scholars of this century who died young. He was about 35 years old when he died. And he had written a number of books. He was a very promising student of knowledge, studying under the leading scholars of his area and his time. And so much so, he was such an aggressive student that his teachers asked him to write books on different subjects. And he would either compose poems in which he would gather all of the principles of a given subject, as scholars of the past did. This was a traditional way to simplify and to, or we wouldn't say really simplify, but we would say to condense rules for students to make it easier. They'd put it in a poetic form. For example, one of the famous poems is called Alfiyat ibn Malik. Alfiyat ibn Malik is a thousand lines of poetry in which all of the rules of Arabic grammar and syntax are included. So a person who memorizes that has it all. Later they teach you the commentary on it, because actually when you read it, you know, for a person who, even with a good Arabic background, they read it, it's like a puzzle, you know, because the poets will always, or the authors who make these lines of poetry, will, you know, shift things from their normal positions in order to keep things rhyming. Because you imagine, you want to make grammar rules all rhyme, you're going to have to do some playing around. So a person who doesn't know all these rules themselves, and when he reads it, it will appear puzzling. It will appear puzzling. So what they usually did after that is to write a commentary on it. So the poem was to facilitate for students the memorization of all the rules. And you have what they call Alfiyat ibn Alfiyat al-Iraqi, where one of the leading scholars of the past, al-Iraqi, he gathered up all of the rules of hadith. You know, the hadith science, ulum al-hadith. He put it all together in a thousand lines, poetry also. You know, so because so much of learning in the past depended on memorization, so these were all tools used to memorize. So Al-Hakami, he had written a number of such poems, gathering areas of knowledge for students who would be following him. And he also wrote a number of books, among them, in a number of subjects, among them this particular text that we are looking at. Now, there is a copy of this available for those of you that are not aware. There's a copy of it available on Salafi Publications. And I don't necessarily advise to read everything that's there because there is some elements of extremism. But they do have the text there, and we've made copies of it, actually. Some people knew about it and made some copies, and Abdurrauf wanted people to do a lot of writing, so he didn't give them the answers. You see, he brought all the questions, and deleted the answers, and that was thing was distributed. I don't really see anybody with it, so I don't know why that is. You don't have those. But anyway, we can make a copy of the text for you with the answers that you can also follow study. We can follow it yourselves. I mean, I'm doing further research, you know, beyond what is there in the text, and that I'll have, you won't have. At the end, inshallah, you can get it. Anyway, we reached as far as question number 137. And of course, this is different from the numbering in the Arabic text. There's a difference of one. I haven't figured out why that is exactly. Perhaps
the same number twice earlier on.
In which text?
The Arabic one. They use the same number twice.
Oh, so the Arabic is off. Okay. Right. Thank you. So the reason why there's a difference for those who are following it in the Arabic is because in the Arabic text, they have used the same number twice. And this is why they end up being one number behind. Anyway, so the English is accurate. This question number 138, what is the proof for belief in Qadr? And the answer given, the evidence for belief in Qadr can be found in the following statements of Allah, the Most High. And the author there lists basically six verses from the Quran and three hadiths. وَكَانَ أَمْرُ اللَّهِ قَدَرًا مَقْدُورًا in Surah Al-Ahzab, verse 38. لِيَقْضِيَ اللَّهُ أَمْرًا كَانَ مَفْعُولًا verse 42 of Al-Anfal, that Allah might accomplish a matter already ordained. And in Surah Al-Ahzab, verse 37, وَكَانَ أَمْرُ اللَّهِ مَفْعُولًا Allah's command must be fulfilled. I don't know why the author actually put 38 first and then put 37 afterwards, because they're related anyway, but we'll just do it in the order that he did it. And وَمَا أَصَابَ مِن مُصِيبَةٍ إِلَّا بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ وَمَن يُؤْمِن بِاللَّهِ يَهْدِ قَلْبَهُ No calamity befalls but by the decision of Allah, and Allah will guide the heart of whoever believes in Him. That was Taghabun, verse 11. And وَمَا أَصَابَكُمْ يَوْمَ الْتَقَى الْجَمْعَانِ فَبِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ And what you suffered on the day the two armies met was by the leave of Allah. That's Surah Ali Imran, verse 166. And we have the last of the verses from Surah Al-Baqarah, 156, 157. الَّذِينَ إِذَا أَصَابَتْهُمْ مُصِيبَةٌ قَالُوا إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ أُولَٰئِكَ عَلَيْهِمْ صَلَوَاتٌ مِّن رَبِّهِمْ وَرَحْمَةٌ وَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْمُهْتَدُونَ And there are four hadiths. We'll look at those hadiths after we finish the section on the Quran. So let's go back. He said the evidence for belief in Qadr can be found in the following statements of Allah. Before looking at the evidence for belief in Qadr, it would be good to know what exactly Qadr is. Right? And Qadr, the term Qadr, comes from the root qadara, which means to evaluate. Qadara means to evaluate. And it may be defined as Allah's predestination of everything for His creation, in accordance with His prior knowledge. The predestination of Allah for everything, everything of His creation, in accordance with His prior knowledge. Okay, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salam, rasulillah. Just to allow the sisters to catch up, for some reason the mic wasn't working. We are at question 138, which was, what is the proof for belief in Qadr? The answer given by the author was 5 verses of the Quran and 4 hadiths. And we began to look at the evidence, where he said, the evidence for belief in Qadr can be found in the following statements of Allah, the Most High. We mentioned that it was necessary to first begin with understanding what is Qadr before going on to looking at the evidence. And the basic linguistic meaning of the term Qadr is to evaluate. However, from an Islamic perspective, it is defined as Allah's predestination of everything for His creation in accordance with His prior knowledge. Allah's predestination of everything for His creation in accordance with His prior knowledge. It is Allah's decree or decision. It is Allah's decree or decision. As in the verse, Inna kulla shay'in khalaqnahu biqadr. Indeed, I have created all things according to predestined proportions. Here is Qadr used directly with this meaning. Everything was fixed in its proportions according to Allah's prior knowledge. Also derived from the same root of the word, the verb qadara, is qadr. As in the text, as it's translated into English, they translate it as qadr. Now the term qadr, that is without the fatha on the dal, qadr and qadr, right? Qadr we're looking at now. This is a verbal noun from the same verb qadara, what they call the masdar. It is virtually synonymous with qadr. It's virtually synonymous with qadr. Although it does, in terms of usage, have other implications. It's used to generally mean the amount of something, right? The amount of something. And we also have Laylatul Qadr. It's not Laylatul Qadr. We know it as Laylatul Qadr. It being the night in Ramadan in which Allah sends down His annual decree and decides the amounts of all things relating to His creation. So, in its usage in general, in this context, in the context of Aqidah, Qadr and Qadar are one and the same. They're synonyms. The other term, which is often referred to in the same context of predestiny, destiny, predestination, etc., is qada. Qada literally means decision. The qadi in the court. He's called the qadi because he makes decisions. He's a decision maker. He makes rulings. So qada generally means ruling. Also, qada has a variety of other meanings. Actually, both of these words have a number of other meanings, because we talk about prayers that we miss when we do them. It's also called qada. So it has a variety of other meanings. But in the context of predestination, qada means the implementation of Allah's decree. The implementation of Allah's decree. As in Surah Al-Baqarah, verse 117, بَدِيعُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَإِذَا قَضَى أَمْرًا فَإِنَّمَا يَقُولُ لَهُ كُنْ فَيَكُونَ. When he decrees a matter, he only says to it, be, and it is. When he decrees here meaning, causes it to come into existence, he only says to it, be, and it is. So qada here is taken to mean the implementation of the decrees which Allah had already decided by qadr. So qadr is basically the decree, and qada is the implementation of the decree. Okay, that is the most popular understanding of qada and qadr amongst the scholars of this area, and a number of others held this view, Ibn Taymiyyah and others. However, there is another view. Right? There is another view held by legitimate scholars of the past like Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani, which is the opposite. It is the opposite. As Ibn Hajar said, the scholars say that qada is the general decree from eternity. Before we said the decree was qadr. They're saying qada is the general decree from eternity. And qadr refers to the details of that decree and how they are implemented. It refers to the details of that decree and how they are implemented. And this is actually the most well-known view. It is the most well-known view in the Muslim world as a whole. It's the view which the Ash'ari hold, the Ash'arites, that is their view. And, you know, scholars from among the Salaf, you know, also held this view. So just be aware that that is a counter view. As is mentioned in Encyclopedia of Islam, the overwhelming accepted position makes qada the universal, general, eternal decree, and qadr the individual development or application of it in time. And that's why when you hear the terms mentioned together, they usually say qada wal qadr. They don't say qadr wal qada. You'll hear it said qada wal qadr. Qada in the most widely accepted view, was the decision, qadr the implementation of the decision. However, texts can be understood to see the opposite. Anyway, when these terms are used separately, they are synonymous. If you talk about Allah's qada, and some, on the other hand, you talk about Allah's qadr, they mean the same thing, including both aspects. When they're said together, this is now when you need to make a distinction between the two. And whether you make a distinction one way or the other way, we see from this that it is both, they're both acceptable. Right? Because there are evidences to support both. Now, Al-Hakami and the scholars of this area who follow the interpretation basically of Shaykh al-Islam Ibn Taymiyyah, they take the other view which I mentioned. Okay, if we go on now to the first of the evidences which Al-Hakami mentions from Surah Al-Ahzab, وَكَانَ أَمْرُ اللَّهِ قَدَرًا مَقْدُورًا. And Allah's command is a determined decree. This is proof for the belief in qadr. This verse, anybody knows what context it comes in? No, this verse concerns the incident of the Prophet ﷺ's adopted son, whose name was Zayd ibn al-Haritha. Zayd ibn al-Haritha. And Zayd was married to the Prophet ﷺ's cousin, Zainab bint Jahsh. Right? And after they were married for a while, about a year or so, problems developed, and Zayd came back to the Prophet ﷺ and wanted to divorce. Right? The Prophet ﷺ, he didn't want this to happen, he tried to hide it, you know, told him to be patient, etc., etc. But it happened anyway. And after it happened, Allah instructed the Prophet ﷺ to marry Zainab. Allah instructed the Prophet ﷺ to marry Zainab, not according to the story which is mentioned in some texts, Tariq al-Tabari, which is well-known Islamic historical text, mentions a story that the Prophet ﷺ, after, okay, I'm not sure whether it's after or before Zayd's divorce from Zainab, he passed by the home or the tent in which Zainab was staying, and the wind blew the cloth door from its position, and he looked inside of the home and saw Zainab there in a state of, you know, home dress, which meant that maybe some of her beauty was exposed, not for sure, if that were the case. And supposedly, seeing her, it went in his heart, so, you know, he desired her. But I think actually it was even before the divorce. This is how it's mentioned in the story, right? But he kept that back or whatever. Anyway, the point is, it's not true. It's in Martin Ling's text, and this is one of the, though Martin Ling's autobiography of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam is one of the best written texts available, you know, for the pleasure of reading, just for reading pleasure, because Martin Lings was a writer, you know, he was an author, British, who converted to Islam. Well, we hope that he did. He had belief problems after his conversion. He ended up in some element of Sufism, which came to be known as perennialism, which basically holds the belief that it doesn't matter what religion you believe in, as long as you're a sincere believer, you will reach God. All religions are like spokes on a wheel, that's how they put it. Right? The hub is Allah, and all the spokes are connected. You know, whichever spoke you come along, you're going to find Allah, as long as you're sincere. So this is, they call this the perennialist belief. He and there are others in Europe, they're popular for these types of writings. Guy Eaton is another big figure, you know, who has written, I think he died just recently, right? Guy Eaton, I think. Yeah. Anyway, the point is that Martin Lings's autobiography, or biography, sorry, not autobiography, biography of Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, is the best written in English. Excellent English, beautiful reading, but he has in it a few errors like this. Right? As he said, he's taken it from the earliest sources, he did, but he didn't take it critically, meaning if this was not authenticated, then really you shouldn't include it. So, Prophet Muhammad ﷺ was instructed to marry Zainab. And this command here, this verse here, which says Allah's command is a determined decree, it means that Allah's command, which He has decreed, must inevitably come to pass. Nothing can prevent it or avert it. For whatever He wills, And whatever he does not decree, whatever he wills happens. And whatever he does not happen. This is the meaning of that verse. And this is part of the principle of acceptance of belief in Qadr. Allah is stating that concerning Prophet Muhammad's marriage to Zainab, the divorce of his former adopted son, Zayd, from her. But it was already written. This is something we must accept. The second verse from Surah Al-Anfal, لِيَقْضِيَ اللَّهُ أَمْرًا كَانَ مَفْعُولًا, that Allah might accomplish a matter already ordained. That Allah might accomplish a matter already ordained. This now was in reference to the Battle of Badr. The Battle of Badr, which was not planned. Prophet Muhammad and his companions didn't set out to go and fight a battle at Badr. This wasn't the intention. They went to that area with what intention? To intercept a caravan of the Quraysh. And this is where the accusation about the Prophet ﷺ and his companions, you know, being highway robbers, right? You know, look at them attacking caravans and, you know, what is this befitting of a prophet? That he should get a band of his followers and go out there and, you know, as a highway robber, you know, stop caravans and take their goods? What is our answer to that? Okay, our brother's explanation is that with the establishment of the Islamic State in Medina, the state now, in order to try to cut off the economic foundation for the Meccan society, this was the step which they took. Well, that sounds nice, you know, from a theoretical position. You know, you're part of your embargo, you're going to stop goods coming in, you know, this kind of thing. Okay, it sounds good. But reality is, it was an issue of revenge. It was an issue of revenge. Because stopping the economic, you know, function of Mecca, it's just one caravan, you know, it's not really going. The caravans are coming from other directions. They're coming from the south also, not just from the north. You know, this was not going to stop their economics, right? It's just going to hassle them. So it was really, it was more an issue of revenge. Meccans were driven out, those people in Medina, the Muhajirun, they were driven out of Mecca. Their properties were stolen. They were forced to leave. They fled. So their economics was taken, so they had a right to go and take back. As an eye for an eye. You've taken some of our economics, we can take some of your economics. Right? So this was legitimate. People had lost. They went to Medina, they'd lost out. They went to Medina destitute. This is to regain something of what they lost. This is their right in that matter. Anyway, that was the intention. However, Allah had another plan. Right? The other plan was that they were going to meet the Quraysh in battle. Right? So instead of catching a caravan, they found an army three times their number. Right? This was the determination of Allah, that Allah might accomplish a matter already ordained. They had a plan, but Allah had another plan. So they were made to fight that battle, and in that battle, Allah brought glory to Islam. They were going in small numbers, Quraysh were large numbers going there, you know. Sure, they're going to beat these people because we tricked them. They thought they're going to find the caravan, and we're coming with, you know, 1,000 plus. They're only 300. So they went there being sure of victory. But instead, Allah humiliated them, humiliated the pagans and idolatry, because they were the symbol of idolatry, and gave victory to Muslims, right? And Islam is a symbol of worship of Allah as He deserves to be worshipped. So the companions, they had no knowledge that this would happen. But Allah knew. Allah had already a plan in place. And it was from Allah's compassion that this was done. Right? It was from Allah's compassion. Because though it involved struggle, some lives were lost, etc., it was a mercy from Allah. Because it gave them a new position in the eyes of others. It encouraged more people to accept Islam, etc., you know, seeing Muslims successful, etc. The third verse, which is from Surah Al-Ahzab also, which preceded the first one, 38, it's verse 37. وَكَانَ أَمْرُ اللَّهِ مَفْعُولًا. Allah's command must be fulfilled. This is also about the Prophet's marriage to his cousin Zainab bint Jahsh, the only cousin that he married. Right? Important point, because Muslims today, especially in these parts of the world, they make the marriage of cousins obligatory. That's it. You're supposed to marry your cousin. If somebody wants to marry other than his or her cousin, you know, say, you know, what is this? You know, you're breaking our traditions. This is Islam. You know, no. Yes, Prophet Muhammad did marry a cousin. And this is also a point which some Westerners and others use to attack Islam, because marriage to cousins for them is not permissible. First cousins, right? Not permissible. But the arguments they use about its prohibition are weak. They say, yes, it causes deformities and this kind of thing. It doesn't. It doesn't. There's an article which came in Jumu'ah magazine. If you'd like copies of it, I can pass it on to you afterwards. Where they explain from a scientific perspective why this argument is false. Continued inbreeding, yes. You know, in any given area, if people just marry amongst themselves, then certain recessive genes will become dominant after over some period of time. And so certain illnesses, if that recessiveness is an illness, it will become dominant in that area. But it's not automatic that simply because you marry your cousin, the likelihood, or your father married a cousin and you married a cousin, that the likelihood that you're going to carry some, you know, some kind of deformity, etc. It's not true. It's not true. It's when it's taken to excess. When it's taken to excess. Anyway, the Prophet's marriage to Zainab broke the taboo about marrying cousins, on one hand. And it also broke an even greater taboo, which was to marry the wife of your adopted son. Marrying the wife of your adopted son, because they treated the adopted son, like they do in the West today, like your real son. So marrying your son's wife, of course, is something objectionable, obnoxious. Same thing they said for your adopted son. So, this act, of course, this was already addressed in Al-Ahzab, verse 4, where Allah said, وَمَا جَعَلَ أَدْعِيَاءَكُمْ أَبْنَاءَكُمْ. He has not made your adopted sons your real sons. So it was already taken care of there. But that's in word. The Prophet's action, you know, puts that seal on it. It puts the seal on it. There's a number of things you see in the Prophet's lifetime which happened like this. Where he told people to do things. They were traveling and they were fasting, going for Umrah. He told them, break your fast, because people were having difficulty with it. But some people broke, but other people didn't. So he had to go out there and drink in front of all of them. Right? To break it. Same thing with Safa and Marwa. Right? Allah said, you know, Inna Safa wal Marwata min Sha'airillah. Because Safa and Marwa were two mountains which, you know, the pagans used to get on top of and you know, praise their false gods, etc., etc. So, to include this in Islamic religious rites, the believers from Mecca had objections. They felt shy to do so. So Prophet Muhammad had to go ahead of them and do it. Show them that it was okay. So this is a practical affirmation of the breaking of the taboo. So the interpretation of Allah's command must be fulfilled is that the divorce and subsequent marriage was predestined and decreed by Allah and was therefore inevitable. Allah knew that Zainab would become one of the Prophet's wives, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and He had destined it. The third verse, or fourth verse, مَا أَصَابَ مِن مُصِيبَةٍ إِلَّا بِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ وَمَن يُؤْمِن بِاللَّهِ يَهْدِي قَلْبًا. No calamity befalls but by the decision of Allah. This is Taghabun, 64th chapter, verse 11. And Allah will guide the heart of whoever believes in Him. No calamity befalls but by the decision of Allah. And Allah will guide the heart of whoever believes in Him. There's another verse in Surah Al-Hadid, verse 22, which carries virtually the same meaning. مَا أَصَابَ مِن مُصِيبَةٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا فِي أَنفُسِكُمْ إِلَّا فِي كِتَابٍ مِن قَبْلِ أَن نَبْرَأَهَا إِنَّ ذَلِكَ عَلَى اللَّهِ يَسِيرٌ. Every calamity which strikes on the earth or in yourselves is inscribed in the book of decrees before I bring it into existence. Indeed, that is easy for Allah. Whatever calamity happens, strikes. In this verse, in Al-Hadid, it was already written. In the verse brought as evidence in Taghabun, right? It was already decided. The writing, the decision, writing being an expression of that decision. So, when we put the two together in these verses, it means that whoever suffered an affliction and knew that it occurred by Allah's judgment and decree, and he patiently abides, awaiting Allah's reward, then Allah will guide his heart, will compensate him for his loss in this life by granting guidance to his heart and certainty in faith. Allah will replace whatever he lost with something similar or something better, according to the tafsir of Ibn Kathir. Verse 166 of Surah Ali Imran. وَمَا أَصَابَكُمْ يَوْمَ الْتَقَى الْجَمْعَانِ فَبِإِذْنِ اللَّهِ. And what you suffered on the day the two armies met was by the leave of Allah. This verse now is in reference to the Battle of Uhud, which happened after the Battle of Badr, where the archers who were set to guard the rear of Muslims, the Muslim army, and they were instructed by the Prophet ﷺ not to leave their positions, no matter what. When Muslims were successful in the battlefield, the archers saw Muslims had defeated, or were in the process of defeating the enemy, collecting up the booty. They became greedy. They didn't want to be left out. So they said, "Oh, the battle's over." Some said, "The Prophet ﷺ said, we're supposed to keep our position no matter what." Some said, "No, it's over now. He just meant during the battle." So they started running down. The other ones who hesitated saw them running. They wanted to be left out, so they all ran down. They ran down to join in collecting up the booty. And this is when Khalid bin Walid, being a pagan at the time, he saw what took place and he brought a rear guard coming from the rear of Muslims, attacked them, caught them in the midst of collecting the booty, and basically defeated them. Or at least we can say took the victory away from them. So a number of Muslims were killed, including the Prophet ﷺ's uncle, favorite uncle, Hamza. And even the Prophet ﷺ himself was injured. His helmet was smashed. His tooth was knocked out. We have that tooth, according to claims, in Pakistan, in Turkey, in Egypt, in Algeria, all over the Muslim world, we have that tooth. Everybody's claiming this was the tooth. But know that this tooth claim is false. Because the only way we can establish the truth of that claim is if they can give us a chain right back to the Sahabi who picked it up in Badr, in Uhud. He handed on to his son or whoever and passed it down. If they can't give us an authentic chain, then we say, this is a lie. This is a lie. Just like in Kashmir, the Hazrat Bal masjid there, it's a big shrine for a hair from the Prophet ﷺ's head. You know, similar kind of beliefs about it. We reject all of these things, you know, because you find they have no sanad, they have no chain of narrators to affirm that these things were collected, actually, from the Prophet Muhammad ﷺ. And there are all kinds of stories people tell me, you know, about it. When you cut the hair, it grows back and they pass it on to other people. And, you know, so it's been shared around in different parts of Pakistan, the hair is, you can find bits and pieces of it all over the place. Anyway, the point is that Muslims suffered that day, right? So what you suffered on the day the two armies met was by the leave of Allah, by Allah's permission. All of it occurred by Allah's will and decree based on His perfect wisdom. So this is, in the previous one, we talked about calamities befalling. We're talking about Allah's decision in a positive sense. But even what appears to be a negative sense, where they seem to have lost the battle then, this was from Allah's wisdom. He had already decided this would take place, and there were lessons in it that Muslims had to learn. And the fifth verse, which is from Surah Al-Baqarah, الَّذِينَ إِذَا أَصَابَتْهُمْ مُصِيبَةٌ قَالُوا إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. Those who when afflicted with calamity say, indeed to Allah we belong, and to Him we will return. They are those on whom are the praises from their Lord, and receive His mercy. And it is they who are the guided ones. So this verse doesn't have any mention of Allah's decision. The others are fairly obvious, by the permission of Allah. The decision of Allah, Allah's command being fulfilled. If you look at the other verses, always mentioned in there, a matter already ordained, a determined decree. Where is the point of evidence in these two verses? When calamity strikes you, those who, when they're afflicted with a calamity, say, indeed to Allah we belong, and to Him we will return. They are those on whom are the praises from their Lord and receive His mercy. And it is they who are the guided ones.
So, I think they believe that the calamity came from Allah. So whatever is the outcome, consequence, it is from Allah. And they accept it. So even if it has to mean that they're going to be ending their lives, they're returning to Allah ultimately. As part of the belief, as far as I understand.
Well, you know, this verse, our brothers mentioned that, you know, it's part of them accepting Allah's decision in their lives by saying, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Prophet ﷺ had taught us to say this, that whenever we say this when a calamity strikes, that Allah will replace whatever we suffer with what is better. Salama was a classical example where he taught her to say this at a time when a person has lost somebody in the family. Usually it's used for people in case of death, but actually it's not limited to death. But any time a person suffers some major loss, you can say that, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. You know? Meaning that, as Prophet ﷺ said, if the person has lost something, if they're patient, they accept it. And this was Allah's decision, that Allah will replace it with what is better. He'll replace it with what is better. So that involves then acceptance of Allah's decree. And Allah before that said, وَبَشِّرِ الصَّابِرِينَ. Give glad tidings of paradise to those who are patient. So this is the expression of patience. إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. Patience which is based on the belief that Allah has decided this for a good reason. There is wisdom in it, in Allah's decision. We accept it, and that's what makes us able to be patient. Because for a person who does not accept the decision of Allah and that it is best, then when calamity strikes them, what happens? They become impatient. They start to blame everybody around themselves, or they may blame themselves. They may, you know, commit suicide or a variety of other things. They can't handle it. This is what tends to happen. So this belief that Allah has already written these things for us for a good reason, this gives us patience, and Allah promises us paradise for it. So if He has promised paradise, paradise for those who are patient when Allah's decree, what He has written for them, strikes them, then it means then belief in it is an obligation for success. For us to succeed in this life, we must believe in it. So this is the what they call wajhul istidlal, or the angle from which the author brought this verse. Then he brought four hadiths. Evidence can also be found in the hadith of Gabriel or Jibril, in which Prophet ﷺ said, وَتُؤْمِنَ بِالْقَدْرِ خَيْرِهِ وَشَرِّهِ, and you believe in the divine decree, it's good and bad. This was about the five pillars of Islam. This was a well-known hadith. You find it in Bukhari and Muslim. Sorry, Muslim, it's hadith number one, in which Prophet Muhammad ﷺ is sitting with his companions. He asked them to ask him some questions. He said to them, ask me about Islam, anything. But they all sat there, shy to ask him about anything. So Allah sent Angel Gabriel in the form of a human being, a man, they said, who looked like Dihya, one of the Prophet's companions, who walked in amongst them and sat down right in front of the Prophet and began to ask him the questions. Right? What is Islam? What is Iman? What is Ihsan? What are the signs of the last day? When is the last day? So the Prophet gave the answer to what is Islam and what is Iman. And in his answer to what is Iman, the last pillar was that you believe in the divine decree, it's good and it's bad. So the hadith of Jibril, where he defined the sixth pillar of Iman as to believe in the divine decree, it's good and it's evil. Khairihi wa sharri. That is evidence that belief in Qadr, which was the question, what is the proof for belief in Qadr? This is clear evidence. Also, Prophet Muhammad ﷺ said, know that whatever has befallen you could never have missed you, and that which missed you could never have befallen you. This is another hadith in another context. Actually, it was narrated by Ibn Ad-Daylami, which he said, I went to Ubay ibn Ka'ab and said to him, some doubt about Qadr has occurred in my mind. So relate something to me that perhaps Allah will remove it from my heart. He said to me, if Allah punished the people of the heavens and the earth, He would not do any wrong to them. If Allah punished all of the people in the heaven and the earth, He would not have done anything wrong to them. If He had mercy on them, His mercy would be better for them than their deeds. If He had mercy for them, His mercy would be better for them than what their own deeds would have earned them. And this is why we talked about before, whether one's deeds carry us to paradise or not. And Prophet ﷺ said that it is the grace of Allah, God, that takes us to paradise. And if you spent in the cause of Allah the equivalent of Mount Uhud in gold, Allah would not accept it from you until you believe in Qadr. Allah would not accept it from you until you believe in Qadr. Actually, this part of the hadith has a stronger proof for belief in Qadr than the part which the author actually brought. He just brought a piece of the hadith. Students knowing exactly what the whole hadith was, you know, would know it. But for us, really, the greater element of proof is there. And then the explanation of it, Prophet ﷺ went on to say, and know that whatever has befallen you was never going to miss you. And that which missed you was never going to befall you. And if you died believing other than this, you would enter the fire. And if you died believing other than this, you would enter the fire. Then I went, this is Ibn Ad-Daylami, he went on to say, then I went to Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, another leading companion of the Prophet ﷺ, and he said something similar to that. And I went to Hudhayfa ibn al-Yaman, and he also said something similar. And I went to Zayd ibn Thabit, and he narrated it to me from the Prophet ﷺ. The third hadith, if something befalls you, do not say, if only I had done this, such and such would have happened. Instead say, it is the decree of Allah, and He does what He wills. If something befalls you, something happens to you, don't say, if only I had done this, such and such would have happened. We do this all the time. Prophet ﷺ said, don't say this. Instead we should say, Qadarullah wa ma sha'a fa'al. It is Allah's decree and He does what He wishes. That is actually again a part of another hadith. Abu Huraira, he related that Allah's Messenger had said, the rest of the hadith, a strong believer is better and more beloved by Allah than a weak believer. But there is good in both. Cherish what benefits you and seek help from Allah and do not lose heart. Seek help from Allah and do not lose heart. And if anything befalls you, that's the rest of the hadith, do not say, if only I had done this, such and such would have happened. Instead say, it is the decree of Allah and He does what He wills. The rest of the hadith, for surely if opens the door for Satan's work. If only, lo, this is the opening for Shaitan. Once you say if, Shaitan is in your head giving you all the other possibilities that it could have been, and so you feel sad, you feel, you know, the loss, and you feel you want to blame somebody, and all these other things, Shaitan has got you now. Prophet ﷺ said, don't say if only I'd done this. Why? Because it opens up the door for regret, sadness, in other than its place. Of course, there are times when you've done things which are wrong. Don't say, I should not have done that. To say to yourself, I should not have done that is perfectly okay. I should not have done that. It is wrong. And I should feel sad about it. That sad that I did it. But at the same time, knowing that it would not have taken place had Allah not permitted it to take place. Right? Not thinking that it's okay because it took place, because there's two different things. Right? Allah permitted it to take place, so it is by Allah's will also. I am still in the wrong for having chosen to do this thing, but in the end, Allah has permitted it to happen. I should feel sad, turn back to Allah in repentance, etc., etc., but not go into depression. Don't go to an extreme in that, where you feel, you know, the whole world is ended and, you know, you're lost and there's no point anymore. And it's no. Allah forgives. He's able to forgive everything but shirk if we die in that state. So know that if we are sincere in our repentance, we can gather back our affairs and go forward from it. Learn from our mistake. You know, build. That's the key, if we're able to learn and not keep repeating it over and over again. The last hadith mentioned by the author, Al-Hakami, is the Prophet ﷺ said, كُلُّ شَيْءٍ بِقَدْرٍ حَتَّى الْعَجَزْ وَالْكَيْسِ. Everything occurs by decree, even inability and capability. Inability and capability. This is actually again a part of another hadith. Tawus reported, I met some people from Allah's messengers, companions, who said, everything is by qadr. And I heard Abdullah ibn Umar quote Allah's messenger as saying, everything is by qadr, even inability and capability, or capability and inability. So even the ability to do something, the desire, the effort, all of this is by Allah's qadr. He has created everything. Everything is included in His creation and apportioned accordingly. Because that's something real, we know. Some of us are born, growing up, we can run fast. Some are slow. Some are higher IQ than others. This is abilities and inabilities. This is not by our decision. We come into the world with it already. And Allah has decreed what each and every one of us will have. What amount we'll have of these things. Now, Allah doesn't reward or punish on the basis of that. He rewards and punishes on the basis of what we do with those abilities. How do we deal with our inabilities? So this hadith, you know, takes it down to the human makeup, the nature of human beings, that whatever abilities, capabilities we have already been fixed and decided by Allah for a good reason. For a good reason. And it's important, again, because we have people, I know you read about stories in the newspaper of, in India especially, it seems to be common, you know, where kids, they don't do well in their exams, they're killing themselves. Hanging themselves from a variety of different locations. In Japan also too, a lot of pressure in the society to produce and to be first in your class, or the top 10 or whatever, so you can be chosen for this institution, that institution. Huh? Yeah, it happens here too. But, you know, of course, the local people, they, you know, as long as you're local, then you're guaranteed you can get in anywhere you want. But, I mean, in the expat community, yeah.
Yeah, not
MIT. MIT. Yeah. MIT also, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's all over the world, really. People where they have done their utmost. See, because it's one thing where you didn't make the effort and you did bad. Okay, you know whose fault it was, right? But when you did your utmost, you worked hard, you studied, you did everything you could, and it just didn't happen the way you wanted it to happen, and you failed, or you did poorly, or whatever, then you ask yourself, why? Why? Why me? You know, why is this happening to me? And if you don't have that understanding, well, you know, as long as you've done your best, that's what, you know, is pleasing to Allah. As Allah, the Prophet ﷺ had said, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُحِبُّ مِنْ أَحَدِكُمْ إِذَا عَمِلَ عَمَلًا أَنْ يُتْقِنَ. Allah loves from each and every one of you. If you do any deed, do it to the best of your ability. So that's what's from you. If you have done your best, then that's what's pleasing to Allah, no matter what happens in the end. So that's the kind of consciousness, very important, especially in schools. You know, this is something missing in many of our Muslim schools. This consciousness is not there. The big reward, who's first in the class, who's the top in the school, and, you know, but we don't give the reward for the one who has made the greatest effort. In some schools, you have this thing about, or some awards they give for greatest improvement, and that's really what is most important. The person has built up from what they had. You know, that really shows the effort, as opposed to one person who just happens to be so intelligent, and so they get number one. And really, in the Muslim school, what the top prize should be is for what? The best Muslim. You know? Because when we tell them the top prize is the top academic, then we're telling them also, we're sending wrong messages, isn't it? We're giving wrong signals here. So what does that put in the heart of the child? by any means necessary, right? So you'll cheat, you know, you'll copy, you'll, you know, bring your notes into, you know, your exams, because some kids do it and get away and they get the top marks. So that's what your goal is, right? So that's wrong. Wrong. Very, very important that we instill in the children, you know, the correct values. So we give the top reward. We give some reward for academics also, but our top reward is for the best student in terms of their character, most respectful, so on, so on. So we're telling the students, we're giving the students a message. We give them the reward also for the academics, but we're giving them the message that the greater and most important thing is that they have good character as Muslims. Okay, that basically covers the evidences for question number 138. Are there any questions on what we've covered so far, question 138?
There's a general question when you're discussing politics. How far a person himself individually independent can make a choice? It's generally when it comes up in discussion. And if he is all free to tell me, he has no choice, how can he be accountable for what he's doing?
Okay, brother's question concerning individual choice and Allah's decree. That if Allah has decreed something, then where is the choice of the individual? I mean, this is an area, of course, and we're going to look, we just began to look at Qadr, right? He's brought the evidence for that you have to believe in it. Now he's going to go and look after this at the different levels of Qadr. And as we go into this, we'll look at these issues in more depth, you know. But enough to say just briefly that what Allah has written is the choice that we were going to make. Not that we don't have a choice. We have a choice. But Allah knew that choice before we made it. Of course, there are other issues that come along with that. You know, if Allah already knew the choice that you're going to make, then are you really making a choice? You know, but anyway, we don't want to go all the way down that road right now. Just the basic answer for the question, that's it. From the sister's side, we have a question about where a person says, I shouldn't have done so and so. Not over something which was sinful, because I mentioned if it was sinful, then you should say, I shouldn't have done that. But if it's not sinful, it was just a choice, you had two choices. You could have done this or you could have done that, and you chose to do this. Should you say to yourself, I shouldn't have done that? Well, of course you can. You could say, I shouldn't have done that in the sense of there were some factors that you should have taken to account, you know, that you learn from your mistake. Right? It may not be a sin, but it's still a mistake. We can still learn from mistakes. The idea of not saying, I shouldn't have, meaning if only I hadn't, this is where we now go into a sense of failure, a sense of sadness, etc., because over something that really was Allah's decree, and you know, we should just accept that decree. Right? So the idea of learning from one's mistakes doesn't rule out, you know, the acceptability of saying, you know, I shouldn't really have done that. That wasn't the best choice. There was a good and a better. Allah corrects the Prophet ﷺ in some of his choices in the Quran, Battle of Badr, etc. So if there was no issue, and then he goes on to say it was already written, Allah already knew it. So we accept that element of it, but at the same time, there's still good choices and better choices. The other question had to do with abilities and capabilities that is coming from Allah. That earlier we had said, the Prophet ﷺ had said, that we shouldn't desire what other people have. And the question was whether this is included under the heading, general heading of capabilities and abilities. I would just say that sometimes it may be and sometimes it isn't, because some of the things you may desire that people have has to do with something which Allah has bestowed on them, external to their capabilities. And sometimes it is something which is intrinsic in them, which Allah has created them with, which you just don't have, which you can't achieve because it wasn't given to you, you know, in that sense. So it may be included, it may not be included. In either case, whether it is or it isn't, you know, we are discouraged from desiring what other people have, except in three occasions. The Prophet ﷺ had mentioned, you know, and really as examples of where it is something positive and your desire for it is something positive. You see somebody knowledgeable who's teaching, you desire to have that knowledge, right? And to be able to teach and to benefit others as they're doing, and so on and so forth. He gave other examples which indicate that where it is something positive and you desire it for yourself to be able to do something positive, it's permissible. But it is the negative element where you desire what other people have and you wish they didn't have it, as one element, right? You know, which is really an evil element. Or even just desiring it, you know, and it's really not something which is particularly desirable Islamically. It's not necessarily something good for you, it is just a part of the dunya. Really, that is the area which is not liked by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, inshallah, we stop here. Subhanakallahumma bihamdika, nashhadu an la ilaha illa ant, nastaghfiruka wa natubu ilayk.